Good morning. Welcome to March 5th. It looks more like January 5th out there. I'm Richard Zarowski. This is the Science Files on Saturday, and got an interesting show. This is show number 5 coming up, and we're going to talk about the effects of media on how science is interpreted by the public. And I get asked a question over and over and over again, why science? Well, basically, science is important to me because the answers are really simple. It works. You can always rely on science, always. Science doesn't require me to believe, doesn't require me to have faith, and it doesn't work in mysterious ways. It's really straightforward, simple, and powerful. The method of science is deeply satisfying and begins with asking questions. Then all you have to do is observe, test, record the results of those tests, and share it with other people. If you do that, you are a scientist. The really funny thing about all of this is that science has only really happened once in all of human history. 500 years ago, a collection of small city-states in post-medieval Italy finally got it right, put it all together. Folks like Galileo, Bruno, Da Vinci, and a host of others found that they had the key to how to look at the world through science and shared it with the rest of the world. So, the funny thing is, why are we struggling with science? Why do we have so much anti-science happening out there? I would posit that it's because of the business that I've chosen to be in, the media, that we have so much anti-science out there. So today on show number 5, March 5th, 2016, joining me will be Dr. Rob Thacker. He's the professor of astrophysics at St. Mary's University. Also joining me will be Mark Kirshner, president of Product Care, a not-for-profit organization which specializes in the complicated world of recycling. And last but not least, Dr. Lindsay Carmichael. She's a children's author, she's a biologist, and she's a scientist. And we're going to talk about how we talk to children about science through writing, through books, and through science itself. Now, joining me in studio, every Science Files, is my good friend, and he was the host last week, Dr. Rob Thacker from SMU. And we're going to do a number of things today. First of all, we've got some giveaways. We're going to set that up. And my producer, Leah Batstone, is going to be taking names for those folks who would like to have a copy of my book, The Maritime Weather Book, which I think I might even sign as well. And we're going to set up a little bit of a contest through the show so that you can call in and see if you're eligible to win. Leo will be the person that makes that decision. And we're also going to talk about this day in history 500 years ago, or this year in history 500 years ago, what happened in science. But first off, let me introduce Dr. Rob. We're going to call him Dr. Rob from now on. He's going to be branded.
Good morning, Richard. How are you doing?
I'm doing well on this snowy day. It looks like 5 to 10 centimeters of snow out there.
And the roads are absolutely treacherous coming in. We were slipping and sliding all over the place. So I hope the snowplow drivers, who've done a pretty good job this year, I must say, I hope they're out.
Well, they haven't had any snow to shovel.
Well, we've had a couple of big dumps, but you're right. Compared to last year, yeah.
Yeah, it really had. Actually, I don't think they did a great job today. I have to say, on my way here this morning, it was single lane.
Well, that's why I'm hoping they're out there right now.
I'm hoping they're out there as well. This little nudge towards you people with plows, get out there. Anyway, so what turned your crank as far as science goes this week, Rob?
I have to say that the thing that everyone's been asking me about is Scott Kelly coming back down to Earth after being up on the International
Space
Station.
That's kind of an obvious one, yeah.
Yep. So, I mean, but the thing about that story is there's a thing in the background that no one's really talking about, which is what that whole mission is really about. And it's really about comparing genetics And so one of the things that people are being quiet about this for...
He's a twin, isn't he?
He is a twin, right? So you have the person down on the ground who you can study and the person you put up in space you can study. But there's going to be so much known about him now that life insurance companies will know whether or not he is a possible candidate for certain kinds of diseases, genetic diseases, and so on. So this is all being kept very quiet. All of that information is going to be have to
it's be all
kept.
About money. We start bringing insurance companies in. We're not talking science. We're talking actuarials.
Well, seriously. So what they want to do, though, is figure out how susceptible people are to certain things, and in particular, how different they are whether you're up in space or down on the ground. Because that's the thing. Why are we worried about this? Because you don't want to put five people in a tin can for 9 months, send them to Mars, and then they're basket cases when they get there. They're ill with this and that and so on. So this is serious stuff. And in fact, another thing that NASA isn't talking about is there was a big internal review. How seriously are they taking all the medical issues and saying they've got to take it more seriously? So we can expect to see a lot more research on this.
Okay. Yeah, it's legitimate. I'm kind of tuckered out from the space shuttle, let's get to Mars kind of thing, dominating so much that's happening out there, when in actual fact, it's about trying to attempt to do business in outer space. What can we get a return on here?
I'm going to butt in. So I think getting to Mars, yes, people are interested in what we might get there and what we might do, sort of like mining and stuff like that. But I mean, there's a lot of things that are closer than Mars that are more interesting for mining, like asteroids and so on.
No question of that. But what I'm saying is that the endeavor to get out there is going to lead to closer, more immediate results in technology. This is kind of a technological push rather than a scientific push, as far as I'm concerned.
Gosh, you're being difficult, aren't you? So I'm going to say no. I think that the whole point of getting to Mars, bearing in mind there are other places that you could go to that would give you more monetary return, getting to Mars is about human endeavor as much as anything. I really believe that. And the fact that it's taking so long tells you that it's about human endeavor. This isn't the Cold War. This isn't getting to the moon, beating the Ruskies up to the moon or anything like this. This is really about a slow progress towards something that's the next step in human exploration.
My last word on this before we...
You always have the last word, don't you?
Well, I'll let you have the last word. This is my last word. I view this as a business enterprise that companies are looking to see how they can monetize space. And this is just another step in the process. Now, there's some science being done. And to my point, what I'm saying, my news story has been the fact that we're still not doing anything on climate change, that we sit down with the provinces mm-hmm. and with the prime minister, and we do not have, we've got a lot of hot air going on back and forth, a lot of very, very soft talk. Science is saying we're in crisis. We must do something about climate change. And the politicians are saying, well, we're going to get around to it. Are we going to do cap and trade? Are we going to do carbon tax? No, can't have carbon taxes. And oh, yeah, we can have the pipeline too, when the scientists are saying no. So it's these business interests that keep intruding on science. And that's where I get cynical, where I start to say, we're not really doing science. What we're doing is pushing the forefront of business, which is slightly different.
Well, okay. When it comes to space exploration, there's no question that there is more business involvement in space exploration now than there has been before. I'm not so concerned about whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. I'm more interested in us getting out there and doing more exploration. So SpaceX, Elon Musk, he's getting a lot of hype, done some interesting things, trying to do things that NASA didn't do.
Absolutely. Right? I'm not disagreeing with you on there. But I think the fact that so much emphasis is being put on this mission to Mars, getting people out there in outer space for year after year so that we can ostensibly look at the medical effects, when we all know that...
You're so cynical. Come on.
Well, yes. Yes. That having been said.
Maybe it's because I grew up in the 70s, right? So back in the 70s, everything was about doing new things, building on humanity's frontiers, going out further and so on. And then, yeah, people thought a little bit about what we could do with mining, but it wasn't the dominant conversation. Now, well, yeah, it has come the dominant conversation, because we're not using a lot of government funds to do this anymore. NASA's budget is tiny compared to what it was 40 years ago, right?
Of course, and that's part and parcel of the problem, and the fact that we're having so much difficulty funding things like the 30-meter telescope. It took forever to get that. And there is
no business. Yeah, we got there in the end.
Business. We got there in the end, but look how long it took. You see, there is no business application that I can think of off the top of my head for a big eye to look in the sky, especially if you're looking
Okay, so
billions of light years down the road.
What we're really getting down to here is the social good of science as well, and how that's
got it. Bingo.
By the wayside.
There you go.
And I've got to say that I would agree with you on that. And in particular, when we can talk about climate change, yes, we can argue about the precise details of the science, but by and large, the scientific case is really quite well understood. Precisely whether it's going to be 1.65 Celsius, 1.8 or 2.2 or whatever, that's difficult because we simply don't know what's going to happen with the CO2 emissions over the next few years. But the cause and effect
they're going
is
to go up.
Well,
we know.
Understood, right? So at the end of the day, yes, I do believe that we're getting to the point where understanding how much science benefits society is something that we're not appreciating the same way we did 30 years ago.
Yeah, so the roundabout way of looking at this is that you and I basically agree, but how we get to that point is
I'm trying to give you a hard time on some things.
Absolutely. Now, if you're sitting out there wondering what's going on, it's Richard Zarowski's Science Files, and in studio right now is Dr. Rob Thacker, professor at SMU, professor of astrophysics. If you'd like to join in on the conversation, our number locally in Halifax is 405-6000. Do not forget the 902, which I'd like to every once in a while when I'm dialing my phone. If you're outside of the immediate area, it's 1-877-801-8255, and we will take your call and you get to have your opinion on this. Now, what else in science other than putting men out there has turned your crank this week, Rob?
What else did I see? There was this thing from McGill University about discovering these objects called fast radio bursts. Obviously, it's another astronomy thing.
That one I like. Yeah. I like that because, here we go. The computer has decided to shut itself off. I like that one, Rob. I think that one is really interesting because you don't have any business applications unless you can sell to aliens. If we discover these are little green men and we can actually create a market to sell.
Well, someone did say that these fast radio bursts are actually a message that they want us to send them pizza. But anyway, so what basically this is about 15 years ago, I think it is, we discovered these very short pulses of bursts, happened very quickly, didn't know where they were coming from. Are they coming from within the galaxy? Are they coming from outside the galaxy? But they're so quick that you can't go and see them with another telescope. And what they...
How quick?
Milliseconds, right? It's really quick. So now what they've discovered is a series of these from an object. And so there are lots of theories about what they are. We think it's basically related to these very, very compact objects called neutron stars, incredibly dense material, nuclear material, but a few kilometers across, and things falling down onto them, perhaps releasing energy out when that happens. And so there are a lot of different theories, but here's the thing. We're in a really interesting situation with these things that we really don't fully understand what they are. There's a lot of theories, but we need more data. So science to the rescue, get more data, right?
Absolutely.
And so one of the things that I'm not really associated with this, but I know a lot about it, is the new radio telescope called the Chime Radio Telescope going in Penticton. First major telescope built on Canadian soil in 30 years. First major research telescope built on Canadian soil in 30 years. And they're going to be looking for these objects with that telescope when it starts to come online in a few months' time.
Speaking of that, I did want to comment on telescopes. Mm-hmm. The Burke Gaffney Telescope at SMU, you can actually tweet.
Yes, you can.
And it's first in the world.
We believe so, yeah. Awesome work by our observatory director, Dave Lane. In fact, when he put up the simplified diagram of how it works, there's about 20 different boxes all connected together. But if you're just on Twitter, all you have to do is tweet to it. I think it's BGO Obs is the tweet handle, or you can search and find it. And then someone will look at what you're asking for and decide whether we can give you access or not. We need to have your full name and things like that. And then you can start sending tweets to take pictures. This is obviously not going to a library. This is going to take a real picture for you. You may not get it there and then. You may have to wait a day or two. Or it may say, you know, I can't actually take a picture of that. That happens because people request things in the Southern Hemisphere and stuff like that.
You know, you're listening to the Science Files. It is Saturday, and I'm here with Dr. Rob Thacker. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some children's science and writing science books. If you're interested in that, stay tuned. Good morning. We're into the second quarter of our show, and sitting in studio with me, Dr. Rob has had enough of my diatribes, so he's left for a few minutes, and in his stead we have Dr. Lindsay Carmichael, who is a professor at St. Mary's University. She also teaches writing, and she is an award-winning children's science author, and she's got a number of books out, among them Fuzzy Forensics and Fox Talk, and she's in studio. And she's going to talk to us over the next 15 to 20 minutes about being a children's science author. And I'm really pleased that you're in studio, Lindsay.
Oh, thank you.
So, and I've got your microphone on.
Okay.
There you go.
That's a good start.
Yes, it is a good start. So first off, you must be really wealthy. You're an award-winning author, and you've sold all these books. And are you heading off to Hollywood?
That would be very nice, but I have to say that the only type of writers who make less money than children's science writers are the poets. We're in this for the love, not for the wealth, but there's enough love and enjoyment involved that it's totally worth it.
Very often when we talk about science, we tend to forget about the kids. We tend to forget that if they don't get engaged, they become non-science people.
Yes, yes. And I think there is a very narrow window of opportunity there. Young kids are all about the science. They absolutely love it. But as they get a little bit older, they start to get this idea that science is boring or worse, irrelevant. And I'm not really sure how that switch happens, but it's tragic. And I think that the key is getting kids convinced that science is actually cool when they're still young enough to be receptive.
Your books are written for what age group?
I've actually written for all age groups, K through grade 12, yeah, depending on the subject matter.
So why did you decide to specialize? I mean, you've got a PhD in biology.
I do.
And you're at SMU. I mean, you're talking way up there as far as what most people know about biology and science and all that kind of stuff. What got you thinking about children?
Well, I do have a PhD, but I'm not actually a professor. I should point that out. I work at SMU, but I'm not a professor. And I think in my case, the more appropriate question is, how does somebody who wanted to be a writer since the time she was a child end up with a PhD in genetics?
Okay, so yeah. You're a writer who happens to also want to be a scientist.
I'm a writer who listened to the excellent advice that it's very important to have a day job that is practical. And I loved science. I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And I especially loved genetics. So that's why I chose to follow science in university. But then I discovered that I am not cut out to be a research scientist. As much as I love science, I would much prefer to talk about it than to actually do it.
So you're one of the great unwashed who likes communicating science.
I do. I love the communication of the science and getting people excited about science.
What made you write about science, per se, though? I mean, you're a writer. Why did you choose to write about science? And why did you choose to go into genetics and biology?
Mm. I chose genetics and biology because when I was in the 12th grade, I read Joseph Wambaugh's book, The Blooding, about the very first forensic case that was solved using DNA fingerprinting, the first murder that was solved. And I thought that was the most fascinating thing ever. And genetics is absolutely amazing. So that's why I chose
Well, every
genetics.
Television show is predicated on, let's send out the DNA lab reports and get that criminal.
It is now. It was not always so. So that's why I chose genetics. But in terms of writing about science, I think it was the realization that I loved science, that I was good at talking about it, and that there was a need for people who can actually explain science to kids in a way that is not teachy per se, but will actually get kids excited and involved.
Is that an issue in the sciences today? Is the communications part, are you either a scientist? It seemed to be unusual that you cover both strands, that you're a scientist and you're also a writer. You don't see that very often.
It's true. I think a lot of people go into science because they don't enjoy writing, because they like the numbers and the facts and the data. So having both of those skill sets does make me a little bit unusual, but also very attractive to publishers in that sense. And I think that might be one of the reasons why I am good at communicating to kids as well, is because I have this enthusiasm for science and I can convey that through my writing. At least that's my goal. That's what I try for.
Well, the excitement about science, in many ways, my particular bent is also, I really love science, but I found out that I really enjoyed the communications about science, getting into the public sphere to talk about science, not only with other scientists, but with people who wouldn't necessarily otherwise be engaged. And when you write your books, you talk about trying to be engaged, try to be engaging and engage children. Do you find any difficulty when you go to talk to children to get that interest level up there? Do you find that they're all basically interested in science, that we're probably good at turning them off as opposed to keeping them going?
It depends on the age group. This is something I notice when I visit schools. Elementary school kids are excited about everything, which is great. They are a fun group to work with and to write for because they are absorbing facts like little sponges. By the time you hit junior high and high school, they tend to be a little bit more jaded. But
what's going on?
I don't know. I suspect it may have something to do with the sense that when you reach the teenage years, you become more aware of your peer group and how they are perceiving you.
But why does science fall off the grid? Why not social studies, geography, other languages? Because they don't experience the same sort of fall off that science does. We sort of get to a certain point, science and math, get to a certain point. Also, we notice that girls seem to fall off the grid more quickly than boys do, by and large.
Yeah. I know there has been some research suggesting that having appropriate role models makes a big difference, particularly for girls and for children who are members of minority groups. So I know there's been a lot of work in science publishing in terms of textbooks to ensure that the photographs that are presented in those books are showing a range of different kinds of scientists engaged in the work.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I've got a book that's called Timetables of Science. I like reading it. It's almost like a dictionary. And it's got thousands of different scientists. And when I counted up the total number of women throughout history, I came up with 47.
Oh, dear.
Yes. Oh, dear, indeed. And on that note, Leah tells me we have to take a quick break.
Okay.
And when I come back, we'll continue the conversation with Dr. Lindsay Carmichael. Good morning. Welcome to the Science Files. We'll do some housekeeping here. If you want to call in, have a comment, our number is 902-405-6000, our long distance number, anywhere you can get our signal, whether it's on the computer or the web or the internet or wherever, it's 1-877-801-8255. Now, we do have a giveaway, and I posted on Twitter that if you can come up with a really good astro pun, or something that makes fun of astronomy, Leah will be the parser of puns. She will determine who has the best astronomy pun, and if she so chooses, you will get a copy of Richard Zarowski's book of Maritime Weather, and I think it's appropriate for today, given the fact that we do have weather out there. We've got 5 to 10 centimeters of partly cloudy sitting down on the roads, and it does look like the city is moving that, and it looks like it's tapering off, so the weather is getting better. But if you'd like to call in and join in on the contest, you too can have a copy of the Maritime Weather book by Richard Zarowski, yours truly. In studio, I have Dr. Lindsay Carmichael. She is a children's science author, and she works at St. Mary's University. We got too many saints in our universities. What I did want to ask you, Lindsay, is what recommendations would you have for someone who wants to write children's science books?
I think the best advice I can give for any kind of book, but especially for science books when we're dealing with information, is that it's really important to change our mindset. We tend to focus on what we want to teach children, And we need to put ourselves in the mind of our inner 12-year-old and think about what that kid wants to know.
It reminds me of Jim Olson's book, Don't Be Such a Scientist.
Oh, I haven't read that one.
He basically says, scientists, you have a problem. Every time you talk about science, you talk like you're talking to another scientist. So stop doing that.
Yes. Excellent advice.
And stop being such a teacher. Stop mm-hmm. being the informer. The whole raison d'etre of the show would disappear. What we're trying to do is sort of get that out there. But basically you're saying stop teaching the stuff, start engaging the children in this activity and really not calling it science, I guess, make it just like any other activity.
Well, we can still call it science, I think, but it's thinking about science from the perspective of a child and what a child finds interesting. And if the child is engaged and interested in the subject matter, the learning will happen by osmosis. You don't have to teach them because they are teaching themselves.
So they're already engaged. You have to turn them off.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the goal. Get them so engaged that they actually want to stay up after bedtime and read a book about science.
Did you used to do that?
I didn't actually read that many science books when I was a kid, although I do remember going through those phases of obsession as a child.
Yeah.
The dinosaur phase, the horse phase, the forensics phase. And I think that's typical of a lot of kids. They go through those phases. And what's really interesting about science books as well is that kids who think they don't like to read maybe just don't like to read fiction. But if you can tap into their interests with a nonfiction book, they will become the kids that are carrying home stacks from the library every week.
Ah, I see. Mm-hmm. I see. You know, that leads me into another question. For me, science fiction was an important part of my growing up with science. And I remember reading Arthur Clarke and Asimov and those folks, and they got me engaged in thinking about science. What do you think of the role of science fiction in terms of engaging children?
I think that well-written science fiction can have an amazing power to get kids interested in science. There isn't a lot of science fiction out there for young readers. It is an area that is starting to develop a little bit more. But science fiction is a very challenging genre because you have to not only tell a great story, but get the details right. And kids are very harsh critics. If they know your subject matter, they will know if you're faking it. So you have to be sure that you've got that information correct.
So you think there has to be a strong relationship between the science and the science fiction so that you're creating a story that is real in science. So you're not talking fantasy.
I think there's a very big difference between science fiction and fantasy, yes. Yeah. And in fantasy, it also has its own rules, but those rules are much more flexible. If you're writing science fiction, you do have to base it in science reality.
Now, in terms of markets, like how do you choose what you're going to write about for your particular book? Is it an offshoot of what you're interested in, or do you look at the market and say, well, you know, I really haven't seen a book on left-handed newts and I'm going to write a science book about left-handed newts.
That would be a great book. I would totally read that.
Is there copyright?
The great thing about being a science writer is that you never lack for ideas. Science is everywhere. And just being open and aware of the world, you will never lack for ideas. In my case, I do both. Sometimes I work for educational publishers that are creating books based on curricula. So a subject is assigned to me, and that's a great experience because I get to learn about something new.
So the publisher comes to you and says, I would like you to write on this particular topic.
Sometimes, yes. That's how a geneticist ended up writing books on hybrid cars and civil engineering. Other times.
Gotcha.
Other times I get to choose my own subjects, and I do that based on my own interests and things that really appeal to me and things that I know kids are going to love, like fuzzy forensics, which is the intersection of forensics and wildlife conservation. It's CSI meets Animal Planet, and it's based on some experiences that I had as a graduate student, but branches out into this wonderful and little-known world of forensics. And how it is used to actually protect and conserve wildlife.
So you're looking at dead things?
Not always.
Not always?
Not always. And I think that's part of the appeal of the book. The main major case that's in the book dealt with animals that were still alive at the end of the story.
I always had difficulty with biology because I didn't want to deal with these poor dead animals and that kind of stuff. Although botany would have been an obvious choice for me. But is there that kind of squeamishness that might come into things or...
I don't really think so. And especially when you're dealing with kids, the grosser, the better.
Well, you know, when you're dealing with adults, the grosser, the better as well. There certainly is a lot of truism to that. So how many books have you written to date?
My 18th book is coming out in this fall.
What?
Yes. Yeah, I have 17 in print and I've got one more coming in the fall. Yeah.
You're joking. Where do you find the time to? You teach writing.
I teach
scientists how to write, or budding scientists, or, well, you teach anybody who wants to know how to learn how to write. What's the most important thing for you in writing? How do you get that kind of volume out?
Well, I have to admit I'm pretty tired, but I think the passion for the work and the passion for the subject matter and doing that work is what gives me purpose. So I will find the time. I will make the time to do that. I will cut back on my social life and my Netflix time so that I can write.
That's amazing. Now, if you're talking to scientists, let's put on your other hat. You're a writer who happens to be a scientist.
Yes.
I think I can call you that.
Yes. Yep.
What would you say to scientists who would like to dabble in the communications business of print?
I think the first thing to remember is why you became a scientist in the first place. What was it that created that passion in you?
The big bucks.
Oh, that's definitely, oh yeah, for all of us. And the fame.
I can see Rob scratching his head.
Scientists and writers both undervalued, yes. Yeah. But yeah, remembering what it was that got you excited about science in the first place, and tapping into that and realizing that the thing that got you excited is the thing that you can use to get other people excited too.
So you can actually map down to a particular point where you said, yes, this is what I want to do. I want to become a scientist.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the catalyst that made me go there. And so your objective is to tap into that with other children.
Yeah, tap into that sense of wonder and awe, and also that remembering that what you do matters. Why are you researching in this particular area? It's because it's important. Why is it important? Communicate that. That's what gets people interested.
Good. Now I know it. Now I'm just going to go and write books, try to write books. I'd like to thank you very much, Lindsay, for taking the time to come in to talk about science and writing for children, and the good work that you do. I am still blown away by the fact that you've done 18 books. That is amazing. And you've got
thank
a full-time
you.
Job and all that kind of other stuff, and you're a scientist. You're listening to The Science Files with Richard Zarowski. It's Saturday morning. This is show number 5. This is March 5th. If you'd like to call in, our number is 405-6000. That's the local number. Don't forget the 902. The other number, the toll-free number, is 1-877-801-8255. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk with Mark Kirshner, who is president of the not-for-profit recycling organization called Product Care. So we'll join you in about 2 or 3 minutes. Good morning. Welcome to The Science Files. I'm Richard Zarowski, and we've had an interesting show today. Before we jump in with our next guest, Mark Kirshner from Vancouver, who's with Product Care. He's going to tell us all about recycling and how to get people motivated into recycling. If you would like to win a copy of my book, Maritime Weather, we have a contest going on for the worst astro pun. This is in Dr. Rob's honor. Something very punny would be good. Leah will take the calls and make the decision. We'll announce it before the show is out. And right now I am going to do this right, this first phone thing we have going here. Hi, Mark. How are you? Okay. Mark, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hi, Richard. Wonderful. Thank you. I pushed the wrong button, which I do from time to time.
Okay.
Good morning. It's very early in Vancouver, is it not?
Not too bad. It's just coming up towards 8 o'clock. So the sun is up and the day has started.
Well, welcome to The Science Files. Now, you're president of a company, well, I guess not a company, it's a non-for-profit called Product Care. Tell me what you do.
Okay. Product Care Association, we've been around since 1994. We started in British Columbia, which is why our office is here. But what we do is we run recycling programs for specific products. And the one we do in Nova Scotia is paint, and we call it the Paint Recycle Program. And I think what's interesting to your listeners is not just that it's a recycling program, but why it exists and how it works. It's something called product stewardship or extended producer responsibility. So I think they'd be interested to hear a little more about why we're there as much as what we do.
Okay, and so why you're there is, I assume, the fact that we've got some materials that we want to throw out, and throwing things out isn't exactly environmentally responsible anymore.
Yeah, it's what I call the new religion, which is recycling. It's something more and more people are doing, and everybody, I think, is believing in more and more. Nova Scotia is well known to be among the leader of the provinces in terms of the response rate. So what's, first of all, how the program works, we've got collection sites across the province. We mostly work with the Enviro depots that you've got that also do beverage containers, also some of the local governments and some retailers. And as usual, you can go to our website for product care and get more information. But what's different about this product and this recycling program is the fact that it is operated, and funded by the manufacturers and the retailers. So the starting point is that Nova Scotia, way back in 2002, passed a regulation that required any company that was bringing paint into Nova Scotia and selling paint in Nova Scotia to have what we call an end-of-life recycling program for the product that was available to consumers. And what the industry had already done in response to a similar regulation in British Columbia was work together, which is something they don't always do for most of what they do. They're competitors, but in this case, it made sense to work together. They formed Product Care Association. And so when the knock on the door came from the Nova Scotia Department of Environment saying there's now a regulation in Nova Scotia as well, we responded and got busy setting up the program that's now been operating for, I guess, about 14 years, originally working with a group called RRFB Nova Scotia, and who also operate the tire program and the beverage container program there. And they're still involved, but now we're more directly involved in the management side of it. So that's the sort of back end of the program, that it's driven by a regulation. It's the industry getting together, working together, and setting up the program that's operating today.
Well, I'm just looking at your website right now, and I see that you're not just restricted to paints. You recycle all sorts of things.
Yeah, we do different products in different provinces, and we even have some work, a program we do in the United States. So paint is our original one. We've been doing it, as I said, since 1994, but we also are growing quite a bit in lighting products. Fluorescent lamps, other kinds of lighting products we do in different provinces.
Is that because of the mercury?
And another one is, sorry?
Go ahead. Is that because of the mercury in the lighting products?
That's one of the drivers. Now, different products have different reasons why they're sort of higher on the priority list. Some of them is just because there's so much of it, like beverage containers. And others it's because there's some hazard or some risk involved. And that would be the driver behind fluorescent lights, which is... People may know if they're out shopping, there's probably going to be fewer and fewer of them around, and everybody's moving over to the new technology, which is LEDs, which do not need mercury.
Do they present an issue as well?
LEDs do not have the same hazard level. I'm not the expert on this, but the key that made the fluorescent lights work, and it's a wonderful thing because it saves so much energy, but it requires a very small amount of mercury to make them fluoresce. LEDs, totally different technology, a better technology, I think everybody would say, uses even less energy and doesn't need the mercury to work.
Okay, and so you look at a variety of products. Do you do tires in other jurisdictions as well, or do you do small appliances?
We've got our repertoire, and that the main ones are the paint, the lighting products. We also do a group of products we call household hazardous waste, things like pesticides and solvents and that. And it depends on the province. Each province is sort of at a different stage of passing these regulations. And I know Nova Scotia is looking at introducing more products. But there are other programs, other organizations that do the same thing, but for different products. So there is one, for example, in Nova Scotia for electronics recycling. If you've got an old computer, an old printer, you can get a place, find a place to take that and get that recycled.
Mark, I thank you very much. Unfortunately, the show's only an hour long, and sometimes it feels like 5 minutes. And thank you very much for taking the time to give us a call and talking to us about the importance of getting the idea of recycling out there. Before you go, I just wanted to ask you what the weather's like in Vancouver. We're in the midst of a snowstorm right now.
Well, this is one of those days I think we can gloat a little bit. It's supposed to be 8 degrees and sunny today, so and the flowers are coming up. So if you can excuse a little gloating, there you have it.
Well, thank you so much for the gloating as well and for taking the time to talk to us on the Science Files. That was Mark Kirshner, who is president of Product Care, which is a not-for-profit organization that specializes in the complicated world of recycling. You're listening to the Science Files. I'm Richard Zarowski in studio. And our number here is 405-6000 or 877-801-8255. And in studio with me right now, Dr. Rob has come back in again. And he was saying he wanted to finish off a discussion on climate change a little while ago. Basically, the show is about publicizing science. And the object of this particular episode was to say that there are many different ways to publicize science. It could be through private enterprise. It can be through universities. It can be through writing. It can be through children. But another way is in participating on a show like this. And I'm so pleased that Rob sits in every week to chat about things because he gives a different perspective to things. And he wanted to address climate change.
Well, so for me, the problem with climate change isn't actually the science. It's the policy, right? And how we move on to actually doing something about it. That's what I struggle with. Because one of these other things that we have a problem with is everyone wants to put out their opinion on something. And in this particular case, well, opinions don't matter if you're not an expert, right? And it's listening to the experts that I find particularly troubling, that a lot of people, when you see it reported on the news...
But the experts don't make the decisions. So,
but experts are there to contribute to the people who do make the decisions.
However, in Nova Scotia and for the longest time in Canada, there were no experts that were allowed to give advice to the government. And we still don't have a science advisor in Nova Scotia.
Oh, so you're talking about chief science officer and things like that. Well, yeah. I mean, to give credit to the Liberals, I mean, they are trying to bring that into the government level. So the ad for that, I believe, has gone out a couple of weeks ago.
Well, there you go. You can do something else as well. You know, you've taken to this media thing. I wanted to say, you're a scientist, and Lindsay's here came in saying that I'm a writer. Not only is she a scientist, but finding scientists to speak is not difficult. I mean, you've taken to this like a duck to water. You hosted the show last week.
Sure.
You did a wonderful job. This idea of communicating science, the general timber has been that nobody wants to listen to science.
Well, actually, I'm going to say something that I think is a little bit disturbing and has troubled me quite a little bit, is that when I speak up as a scientist, you'll get people who say, well, scientists should be there and say what the science is, but when it comes to policy, they shouldn't be involved in that conversation. And I find that troubling, because if I was just a citizen, no one would ever say that to me, right? And so there's this weird situation that people seem to think that scientists should just advise and then step out and not be part of the policy. Personally, I'd very much like to see more people who have a science background go off and then study policy and get into science. I mean, in the US, I think there are like two senators who have science or physics backgrounds, at least, is what I know anyway. And I'd like to see a bit more of that. I mean, I have nothing against business at all. I worked in merchant banking for a little while before I came into science.
So. And there's Tom Trappenberg over at Dell, who's a physicist, and he's also politically involved. And so we do have people in the sciences that come out and speak. But it's surprising to see how muted that has been over the years.
I think that's starting to change. Now, I'd like to see it change. I'm not saying that suddenly every scientist should be out there, because that's not what we should have. But it should be people in there contributing to the dialogue and so on. I mean, I don't like it when people tell me, well, you're just a scientist, you shouldn't have anything to do with policy. I find that really quite offensive, to be honest.
Yeah, the difficulty in all of this is that science does have a valid input, and very often when we look at the media outlets, there's very little forum for scientists to become involved in the discussion of science, and especially when we talk about television. You know, you might see a scientist on for a 15-second clip.
Well, I think the other thing that, well, the problem is once you start talking about how you act based upon something, then different things come through in different personalities. Some people are more bombastic and some people are more retiring and will say, well, this is the way it is. This is how I think we should go forward. And I think part of that is a little bit difficult for scientists to step into policy discussions just because we're so used to arguing about things we know. And then once you go into policy, you're suddenly in a situation, well, there's a heck of a lot of things you don't know. And you've got to be upfront about that.
Exactly. And you know what? You're getting the last word today.
Ta-da!
So this has been the Science Files. We have to wrap things up. I'd like to thank my producer, Leah Batstone, for handling the phones and for handling the switchboard and all that kind of stuff. And we'll look forward to talking to you on the Science Files next week.